Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Hello and welcome to The Capitol Record, brought to you by National Review's Capitol Matters. I am your host, David Bonson, and we are in the midst of this sort of two-part series, and I may just add a third, fourth, fifth part later on as well, about Adam Smith, as we this week celebrate the 300th anniversary of the birth of the great moral philosopher and father of classical economics, Adam Smith. Last week, we were blessed to have on Dr. Mark Skousen, who waxed and waned about Adam Smith and his strong respect for the tremendous legacy of the great free marketeer. And now today, I'm really pleased to bring on National Review's own Dominic Pinot, who's going to tell us more perspective on Adam Smith, share a little bit from, I think, his unique perch as it pertains to Adam Smith's legacy, where things stand right now in current economic debate, where Smith is seeing greater appreciation, where he's seeing greater discussion, and what those of us who are after the cause of a free and virtuous society can gather from the great Adam Smith. So let's bring on Dominic to Capitol Record. So with that said, allow me to welcome back to the Capitol Record for the second time and a regular and major contributor at our own National Review, Capitol Matters, Dominic Pinot. Dominic, welcome back to Capitol Record.
Hey, happy to be here, David.
So we are kind of doing a little Adam Smith thing here, and by this time, people have listened to last week's Capitol Record, where I had Mark Skousen on, who is quite an Adam Smith scholar. We had a wonderful conversation on all things Smith. I know that you've been really heavily involved in this kind of Adam Smith moment, celebrating his 300th birthday this very week. So tell us, Dominic, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mark last week. Are we living in a moment where Adam Smith is more appreciated than he has been, or less appreciated? Is his stock on the rise, or is it falling?
That's an interesting question, David, and there's a couple different ways to answer it. I guess in one sense, if you look politically, he's probably not as appreciated as he should be. I think there's plenty of areas that Smith would look at, you know, economically and politically and in the culture as well, that he would look at and say, that is not what I had in mind. We need to do better. But there's another sense in which he is actually more appreciated, at least than he was, say, 100 years ago. Books such as The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was his first book, he only ever wrote two complete books. He had lots of other essays and things like that, but he only ever wrote two complete books, Theory of Moral Sentiments in 1759 and The Wealth of Nations in 1776. The Theory of Moral Sentiments, from the time Smith died until about 30 or 40 years ago, was basically ignored by most scholars. People really didn't talk about it very much, and it was kind of dismissed as being outdated and silly. And in the last couple of decades, scholars have really started to take the Theory of Moral Sentiments seriously again. And I think that is a tremendous development, because it's a very deep and rich book that has a lot of really useful insights for us today, but also is just, you know, an important part of Smith's thought that must be considered alongside The Wealth of Nations. They are complementary books. They are not you can't fully understand Smith's thought without really grappling with both of them.
So, do you think that may be kind of a contrarian thesis, but maybe what you're saying is theory of moral sentiments is getting a bit more of a resurgence, and yet Wealth of Nations is losing a little luster. And not that the merit of the work, I know you're not saying that, but that there's a little less fondness for laissez-faire classical economics, and yet a little more appreciation for harmonizing moral philosophy into the way we view economic theory?
Yeah, at least among the scholarly discussion, I think that would be fair. There's been a lot of books written. I mean, there's even been popular books written, right? Russ Roberts most famously had a book for a general audience that's about Adam Smith and theory of moral sentiments and about how you can apply that in your everyday life. And I think those kind of developments, I mean, that's something that you wouldn't have had, 20, 30 years ago.
So the debate right now, it seems to me, because you're right, there's kind of a little different conversation in pop culture, just as far as where we like free markets and where we don't. And obviously within the right, there's a intramural debate about the common good and where the role of political economy may be in bringing about certain social ends and categories of virtue that we would aspire to. I was intrigued by Gori Liu's book that came out late last year that I devoured at the beginning of the year and ended up having her on this very podcast, where I don't have a strong opinion as to what, if any, Gori's own opinion was about Smith, but more just the work she did to sort of uncover what I think amounts to, you know, virtually 250 years now. We're not quite at 250 since Wealth of Nations, but almost since it was its publication, some attempt to interpret Adam Smith according to one's own presuppositions, one's own priors. And I was fascinated by how escalated that was in the 19th century, and then certainly in the 20th century, with certain free marketeer giants that I respect a great deal, particularly out of the Chicago School, were really fond of quoting Smith and characterizing him as a real classic laissez-faire, almost if there was a political attachment, ascribing to him a sort of libertarian sympathy. And yet there is a legacy where Smith clearly believed that there was a need to direct man back to a moral purpose, that mankind's activity in a free economy needed to be free, but also needed to be tethered to some moral sensibility. What is your take, Dominic, on Adam Smith revisionism? Is it a problem? Is it kind of normal? And a lot of people like me and maybe even Gori Liu are making a bigger deal out of it than we need to, because people always do that to scholars, reinterpret or reemphasize them according to their own priors? Or is there something more at play going on here?
I think it's a good thing that more people are reading Adam Smith and studying him seriously, even if I don't necessarily agree with all of their conclusions on it. I think the, you reference, you know, free market people in the 20th century would kind of trot out Smith quotes and just kind of leave it at that. And, you know, I certainly don't think there's anything wrong with quoting Adam Smith. But also, you know, that was in a period of time where, as I mentioned before, you know, hardly anyone was reading the theory of moral sentiments. It had been almost totally forgotten. And so when, you know, there's those handful of Smith quotes from Wealth of Nations about, you know, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher or the baker that we expect our meat and bread, you know, the example of the pin factory, those are all very powerful quotes that really sort of concisely sum up some of Smith's views. And those are good things. But there's just so much more Smith out there. And there's so much more that he said and that he wrote and he thought over decades of his life, and so I think it's good to have a more thorough engagement with the content. And then after that, you know, if we're in a place where we've got a bunch of people who have read Adam Smith deeply and are then interpreting him differently and are sort of debating with each other about the best way to interpret that is a much better place to be than a place where no one's reading him at all.
Well, I certainly agree. And I think that actually even some of the debates where there may be people cherry picking Smith or in some cases outright revising, I think it does invite, and I wrote a review of Lori's book for the Acton Institute that spoke to this. I think that it helps enhance the conversation, not about what Smith believed, but the topic itself, where liberty and virtue juxtapose and what that how that tension is to be held, and then what it means in terms of modern policy administration. And that's where I think it's difficult, because Smith was clearly a quintessential anti-mercantilist, and he clearly, as you point out, 1759, with Theory of Moral Sentiments, was an economist that was really rooted in being a moral philosopher. And I didn't realize until Gorey's book that as late as, I think it was 1870, I mean, you're talking late 19th century, even at the Ivy League, 100 years after Smith, that economics was still sort of tucked into the moral philosophy departments at Harvard and whatnot, and that it really is more of a 20th century and obviously a very Keynesian evolution to separate economics from social science, where I think it belongs, and viewing it more econometrically. And if there's going to be debate about Smith's legacy that helps us restore the conversation of economics to the platform of social sciences and moral philosophy, I think that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I definitely think that's right. You know, there's sort of overly mathematized version of economics that is most commonly taught in most university economics departments today, where an econ degree is basically an applied math degree. And there's a handful of places that don't do that. I was fortunate to go to one of them at George Mason University, where we have a Adam Smith program, and we have we spend a whole semester just reading the Theory of Moral Sentiments, and then we spend a whole semester just reading the Wealth of Nations. And simply by doing that, students that go through that program at Mason have read more Adam Smith than 99% of economists, right? One of the things about those two examples I mentioned earlier, the butcher and the baker quote and the pin factory quote, those are right at the beginning of Wealth of Nations, right? Those are the two most cited things, and they're right at the beginning. What does that tell you? It means people probably didn't read much past that, right?
Yeah,
and it's not to say that those are bad examples or that those are I think those are perfectly accurate and good things to point out and to pull out, and they're very powerful images that stick with people. But there's so much more in there, and it's not until book four of the Wealth of Nations that Smith goes against really goes after the mercantilist. That's the section of the book where he really does that hammer and tongs. And then in book five, he kind of says, hey, this is what we should do instead. And this is how things really work. He talks about defense and revenue and all these different things that are, obviously still relevant today. And so it's really good to go past the sort of quotes that everybody knows and really get down into the weeds on it. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do with our essay series for Capital Matters.
So tell me about the essay series, some of the contributors, some of the points of emphasis that the essayists have brought. It's been, I think, quite intellectually stimulating, but maybe let listeners get a little understanding of what you've been doing there.
Yeah, so the series is called Adam Smith 300. It's celebrating Adam Smith's 300th birthday, which is this year. He was born in 1723. He's born somewhere around June 16th. We don't know the exact date of his birth. It might have been a couple days before that, but he was born around June 16th. And so on the 16th day of each month, we have a different essay go up looking at Smith in depth, kind of from various different perspectives. And so we've had a really good mix of different writers coming and really engaging with Smith, both his life and his career, but also his thought, and trying to do that in a way that a general audience can understand. We had Vernon Smith, who was a Nobel Prize winner in economics in 2002. He wrote for us in February. We've had Samuel Gregg, I believe a past guest of this podcast as well. Mm-hmm. And so he from the American Institute of Economic Research. And so he wrote about Smith and his connection with Edmund Burke. We've had Yuval Levin write about it as well. And so, and one of my favorite ones that we had so far was actually in March. It was by Caroline Brashears, who's an English professor at, and she was writing about how Smith's first job was as a professor of literature and rhetoric, and how important that part of Smith's background is to actually understanding his economic thought. And so, you know, that's the kind of stuff that that you're not going to get other places, and the kind of thing that I think we've been really fortunate to be able to bring to our readers. On such an important year as celebrating Smith's 300th birthday.
When Patricia tried to donate to a conservative organization through her donor advised fund, her request was denied. Why? Because they said she was trying to give to a hate group. That's why she switched to Waterstone, a donor advised fund dedicated to upholding Judeo-Christian values. Waterstone is unique in the world of donor-advised funds. It accepts gifts of cash as well as real estate, business interest, oil, and more. They can help you receive an immediate tax deduction and make a difference for the charity of your choosing. With its charitable pooled trust, you can even generate a guaranteed income stream from your charitable giving. Waterstone strictly adheres to a Christian statement of faith, including a pro-life declaration, does not give to charities that contradict those values. Waterstone is trusted by so many men and women of conviction that they give $10 million per month in charitable grants. They can work with you or your financial advisor to make a giving strategy that fits your needs. Contact Waterstone's Giving Strategies team today for more information by visiting waterstone.org. That's waterstone.org.
So just out of kind of curiosity, why does Mark Skousen believe Adam Smith was born June 5th and you're quoting June 16th? Where is this little historical controversy come from?
I believe June 16th was the date that he was baptized. And I'm pretty sure that is the only date that we have of his. And so it's a lot of times it's quoted as like circa June 16th. So mm-hmm. We don't know for sure the exact date, which is sort of unusual because he wasn't born that long ago, and record keeping in Great Britain wasn't terrible at that time. And like I said, we do have the date of his baptism, but we don't have the exact date of his birth.
I would point out, by the way, with Mark Skousen, who people heard on the podcast last week, is the Distinguished Fellow of Economics at Chapman University. That's actually where Vernon Smith, who yes. published one of the pieces in the series, where he resides now, at also in the economics department at Chapman, although he spent a good portion of his career at George Mason and I think did a stint at Arizona. So Chapman seems to have a bit more of an interest in some other free market advocates, which is rare in academia these days. Tell me about your George Mason experience. I already know that you mentioned, obviously, you were fortunate enough to learn economics at a school that was not in this sort of mathematization of economics problem, and were aware of a lot of the great kind of contemporary Austrians that are there at George Mason. Was Adam Smith a kind of required part? Like, could someone get through an econ major at George Mason and not study Smith, not read Wealth of Nations? Well, I know Russ Roberts. Russ was there when you were there still, right?
No, he wasn't there anymore when I was there. But okay. Fun story about Vernon Smith first as it relates to George uh-huh. Mason. He won the Nobel Prize in 2002. He was at the University of Arizona. You were correct about that. That's where he was before he was at George Mason. And Walter Williams, the late Walter Williams, was the chairman of the department at the time who hired Vernon Smith away from University of Arizona and then to GMU. And Walter took great pleasure in telling people that it was right after he hired Smith that he won the Nobel Prize, and would tell people that there is a wanted poster for him hanging up in the faculty lounge at the University of Arizona. So, but yes, no, George Mason is a great place to study economics. I think the Adam Smith program that I described before is not required for everybody, right? That was an elective that you can do, but it's one of the few places that even offers an opportunity like that for people to take advantage of. And certainly the ideas of Smith are all throughout the department, even on required courses. You know, we have, you're not going to be able to get through Introduction to Microeconomics with Thomas Ristisi, who's the sort of gatekeeper for the department there. You're not going to be able to get through that without dealing with Smith and his ideas pretty seriously and really understanding, classical microeconomics at a pretty fundamental way. And so I think Mason does a really good job. The department does a really good job of making sure that students are exposed to that and at least have the opportunity to go much deeper if they want to. And as a result of that, like I said, I mean, most economists have not read The Wealth of Nations, even though they might know a couple lines and even though they might, you know, refer to Smith as the father of their discipline. They haven't actually read it.
And so it's interesting. I think a lot about the critics of Smith who haven't read Smith, but you're referring to proponents of Smith who may not have actually read Smith.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
And even with Theory of Moral Sentiments, I think it worsens because I do believe that there are a lot of people who have read Wealth of Nations and are reasonably fluent in defending concepts like division of labor. Mm-hmm. And free trade and other sort of ABCs of late 18th century, early 19th classical economics. But then if you were to go into some sort of wedding it to moral philosophy, I think would be uncomfortable. And you know, I, by the way, would say I'm more interested in people debating. Like if someone's critical of Theory of Moral Sentiments because they're not fully sold on Adam Smith's commitment to this idea of sympathy as sort of a foundational component to that moral impulse, I'm perfectly okay with that someone may not be fully convinced. And that was one thing I was unaware of until reading Glory Lou's book, is how much debate there was amongst our founding fathers who had read Theory of Moral Sentiments. This is Madison, Hamilton, Jefferson, Adams, but we're not always unanimously persuaded in the particular approach. But what I am more concerned about is this notion that moral philosophy itself is unnecessary cousin to economic study. And I think that right now, when we talk about Smith as a quarterback for anti-mercantilism, that it does seem to me most of the modern anti-free trade side is very comfortable bringing in moral philosophy, or at least appealing to some ethical absolutes or desired social aims, worker class, you know, things like that, at varying degrees of. Not always persuasiveness, but compelling argumentation. And for the pro-Smith, pro-trade, anti-mercantilist side to engage that conversation without any wedding of it to moral sentiments, I think is a very big mistake.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the sort of anti-mercantilist facts, logic, you know, that kind of argument, that's totally there. That's book four of The Wealth of Nations, right? Like Smith does that. That's true. But, you know, like you're saying, there's more to it. There's more to Smith's thought. And I think that's one of the areas where we as, you know, defenders of free markets need to beef up on a little bit more and make sure that we're that we do a better job of understanding what Smith was doing there. And understanding, too, that, you know, this dichotomy that's been set up between the Theory of Moral Sentiments and Wealth of Nations is not right either. There's been a sort of it's called the Adam Smith problem. It was invented by German social scientists. And like most ideas that come from German social scientists, it's not a very good one. The issue basically saying that Theory of Moral Sentiments is this very, you're talking about sympathy. It's this book that emphasizes the social part of ourself and the ways that we are connected with other people. And that Wealth of Nations is this self-interest, you know, selfish kind of harsh book, and that these are sort of are opposed to each other. And I think that's a totally wrong way of reading Smith. You know, Smith starts Theory of Moral Sentiments by basically saying, look, it's obvious that everyone doesn't always act exactly in their self-interest all the time. And it's obvious that there are times that people do things for other people. And what he's doing in Theory of Moral Sentiments is largely descriptive. A lot of it is descriptive. He's trying to be very careful about parsing the ways that people act and seeing like, okay, if I'm in this situation, you know, I'm thinking about what the other person is thinking about and so on. And he does these kind of thought experiments like this, right? And it's a very deep way of viewing human interaction. And he's always emphasizing the ways that we interact with each other. And he even does that within yourself, right? He talks about the man within the breast, which he refers to. It's sort of like your conscience, right? And so, you know, you have conversations with the man within the breast. So even when you're by yourself, you're still in social interaction. And so it's this very interesting and I think rewarding way of viewing human behavior. And then he gets to Wealth of Nations, where he's talking about policy, and he's basically saying, look, you know, given these things that we know about how humans behave, what should we do practically to make that happen? And if you believe that human beings care about each other on a certain level, that they look out for each other's interests in certain ways, but also that they're self-interested and that they, you know, obviously are looking out for themselves and their families, it doesn't really make much sense to have a giant government intervening in every single part of this, because there are certain amounts of it that are going to take care of itself anyway. And there are other parts of it where the people who are self-interested are going to know how better to solve a problem than some bureaucrat who's not there. And so I think it's a perfectly logical to view those two works together, and to not sort of buy into this idea that you either have to pick TMS Adam Smith or Wealth of Nations Adam Smith, and that these are sort of separate people.
Well, and so I agree. I've frankly been kind of arguing that for a long time before this was a public debate. Now you're right. The Adam Smith problem, quote unquote, which was more, I think, within academia, that centered around the alleged, but I think fictitious, dichotomy between the thesis of both books, is well over 100 years old. But I think the difference now, the Adam Smith problem is a convenient kind of pretext to this new anti-fusionism that wants to state that a sort of affinity for economic liberty is at odds with an affinity for the social good or common good or what have you. And therefore, it does provide an incentive for people to adopt Adam Smith as their own and perhaps even want to lean in by implication to the German social scientist thesis of the Adam Smith problem, that the first Smith book had it right and the second Smith book did not. But much like I would say Smith's work as a scholar, as an Enlightenment philosopher, is best suited being understood holistically, I frankly feel that way about our whole worldview. That my vision, the same thing I talk about in this podcast constantly, of a free and virtuous society, I think is best understood not as two parts or bifurcated, but as integrated and necessarily integrated. You know, there's an interconnectedness, changes the parts. It changes the sum if one of the parts is not there. And I think you have to look at Smith that way as well. What I wish people had done is done some work to explain where Moral Sentiments and Wealth of Nations were allegedly and explicitly contradictory. And instead, what you end up getting is sort of by implication or arguments of omission, that because certain things were not restated or abundantly emphasized in one work or the other, that people would confuse it in the way you've described. I'm okay. I don't think Mark Skousen fully agreed with me on this, but I'm okay with Gory Luz pointing out that Milton Friedman and George Stigler, and I think you could argue the Chicago school at large, in their really wonderful affections for Adam Smith in the 20th century, they chose to not distort what he said, but to ignore some of what he said, to present a portion of Adam Smith that was very compatible with laissez-faire, with classical economics, with a limited view of government and political economy, a high regard for free trade. All of those things I think are totally true. I just think it seems to be people on my side of this current debate that are totally comfortable with letting Smith speak for himself all the time with all of his works out there, because I just have never been able to find what this contradiction allegedly is between liberty and virtue. And that's really what the Adam Smith problem amounts to, is personifying in Smith the broader debate about that tension.
I think it's very well put. And I would, I would say, depending on which generation of the Chicago school you're talking about, between the 20s through the 50s, when those guys were coming up, theory of moral sentiments was largely a forgotten text, right? So yeah, a lot of it is that, it's not even that they were necessarily ignoring it. It's just that no one was reading it. And theory of moral sentiments gives a really, really layered and rich view of justice. And I think this is a really important part for free market people to understand. Smith talks about commutative justice as being sort of the center of what's important, and you can sort of summarize that as my professor at GMU does, Dan Klein. He says, don't mess with other people's stuff. It's a negative definition, and it basically says, don't hurt people, don't take their stuff, don't trespass on their property, those kind of things. These are precise and accurate, Smith says. He says there's precise and accurate rules. And that's at the center of theory of moral sentiments. But a lot of people, some of these more maybe more hyper libertarian kind of people, they just kind of stop there and they say, look, that's justice. Don't do that. There's nothing more to it. But Smith had this much richer view, because you can satisfy commutative justice by just sitting in your house and doing nothing. Now, that's better than going out and hurting people, but it's still not good, right? And so what Smith says is, on top of that, you have distributive justice, which is making a becoming use of what you have, right? So that can look like charity. It can look like, taking care of your family, taking care of your community, those kind of things, right? And there's a sense of justice in that too, where we can say, if somebody has a lot of resources and they're not using them to take care of the people that are important to them, well, that's unjust in a sense, right? That is not something that they should be doing. But that's not a commutative justice violation, right? It's not something you can, that's not involving, hurting people. It's just saying, look, you have the means to do this, so you should. And that's a different idea. Then on top of that, he has what's called estimative justice, which is this idea of properly evaluating things and properly putting things in context. And so we use that term in art a lot, right? We'll talk about, this person did not do justice to this work of art. If they, if there's a great painting or a great musical or play or something, and you kind of don't pay attention to it, or you don't interpret it in a serious way, we could say you didn't do justice to it, right? So that's a third sense of justice, and that's above. Now, obviously, when we're talking about estimative and distributive, those are not precise and accurate. Those are what Smith calls loose, vague, and indeterminate. There's lots of debate about how to go about those things, but it is still a form of justice nonetheless. And then what Smith does, and this is the really important part that goes right back to what you're saying, he says commutative justice, which is at the center of this, right, with sort of distributive justice on top of it and estimative justice on top of that. The flip side of commutative justice is liberty. Because if you live in a society where people don't mess with other people's stuff, that is also a society where there's liberty. And so they're not, they're two sides of the same coin. They are not opposed to each other, and you really can't have a society with liberty if you don't have a society with justice, as Smith describes it.
Just out of curiosity, and if the answer is no, no big deal, I'll move on. But if the answer is yes, I kind of want to ask you a question there. Are you familiar with John Mueller's book, Redeeming Economics, and his critique of Smith, rooted out of his appeal to what he called the three A's, the Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas, which are certainly three figures in history who I extract a lot of value from philosophically and religiously and economically. But Mueller made a pretty harsh critique of Smith out of the legacy of those three. Does that do anything for you? Was that something you studied?
I am not familiar with that book, no.
Yeah, I don't think it got a lot of play outside of Catholic circles. I know that Ryan Anderson reviewed it sometime back. It was a really, really compelling book. There was a lot of great in it. But I brought it up just because, again, as someone who has certain things that I'm really appreciative of the work of Aristotle and Augustine and Aquinas, and certain things that I'm harshly critical of, probably more Aquinas even than the latter two. And yet I didn't understand the need to contrast it to what he perceived to be deficiencies in Adam Smith. And I do wonder if there is something in Catholic social thought against Smith's, you know, contributions as a kind of Protestant moral philosopher out of the Scottish Enlightenment. But that is probably the type of topic that will cause my listeners at Capitol Record to dwindle down to 14 people if I delve.
Well, I will tell you, we'll have an essay later on in the year as part of our essay series from a professor at Catholic University looking at this question. So we'll stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Dominic, as always, really enjoy speaking with you. I think this series has been fantastic. I hope people will really stay focused to it. Great opportunity for learning and appreciating not only a portion of our past as thinkers, but really a portion of our present and future. Very difficult for one to be a free marketeer and not have some debt of gratitude to Adam Smith. I thank you for the work you're doing.
Yeah, thank you, David.
And with that, I will thank you all for listening to yet another episode of Capitol Record. Don't assume this will be the last you've heard of Adam Smith. We're going to keep many of these conversations going here at Capitol Record, just as National Review's Capitol Matters is continuing in this essay series. But in the meantime, we're going to continue doing what we can to defend the cause of a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to Capitol Record. We'll be right back.